2. The happiness I give away. As 21st century people, we are living in a new age of responsibility with respect to values. We have more freedom, but at the same time, we have a more difficult situation in that we ourselves have to decide the values we wish to follow in life. For most people, the ultimate aims of life are harmony, peace, and happiness. The yoga of Jesus is a method in which happiness is not directly pursued. Instead, it grows as a consequence of the yoga, little by little, incalculably, and unexpectedly. At present, there seems to be a great deal of research and discussion in society about the nature of happiness. From time to time, it surfaces into the public domain. Some years ago, I heard a discussion on the radio about personal happiness in Finland. The percentage of happy people was surprisingly high, over 70%. This figure made me think. The experience of happiness is both subjective and relative. It is also related to age. I can imagine adults living in a city. Their moods vary between relative satisfaction, neutral emotion, and anxiety. They may have fleeting and sporadic moments of joy and interpret these feelings as happiness. One may question whether the research has really measured happiness or just contentment with one's current situation in life. Have the people who answered the questionnaire reflected deeply upon their feelings? I think that the outcome of the research would be quite different if people were asked how to become happy in their lives, how to achieve a permanent state of happiness, or whether it is even possible to achieve happiness. Most people would probably answer that in order to be happy, they require peaceful living conditions, financial security, a high position in society, a balanced family, talented children, as well as health for themselves and for their loved ones. When we look at such a list, we soon notice that the happiness that is built on these requirements appears to be uncertain. Financial security could collapse. What if friends betray me or die? What if I'm fired for one reason or another? What if my children are not talented or not talented enough to my liking? What if I or my loved ones get sick or injured or even die? It happens. What if a war, famine, or some other catastrophe takes place? This kind of happiness is on shaky ground indeed. What then is happiness really? Is it earned or is it adventitious? Is it such that we cannot control it or guarantee happy conditions for ourselves? Is happiness an internal emotion caused by the pleasure center, a passing euphoria, like falling in and out of love? Should we pursue happiness in the first place? Is it a gift from destiny, God, or grace? What is the logic of happiness? I titled this chapter after an old song that seems to reveal that happiness has more to do with giving than having. I thought that there was wisdom in the song's title, although it isn't evident in the lyrics. The song is just an old piece of dance music, filled with yearning for past moments of happiness, as this kind of song tends to be. On a closer analysis, the seemingly paradoxical connection between happiness and giving proves to be a profound theme. It is connected with a struggle for existence, with the meaning of life itself, and through this to major issues such as suffering, forgiveness, love, freedom, and truth. We seldom realize that in his most important speech, the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus Christ has provided us with the instructions on how to achieve happiness. This is what the Beatitudes are all about. Jesus here is referring to a high state of happiness. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. The Beatitudes are not simple or easy to understand. Nevertheless, it is worthwhile to try to interpret them correctly. Each sentence, both individually and as part of the whole, is well worth meditating upon with both the spirit and the intuition. The wise teach us that holy texts can be opened with many keys. They advise us to read them with our hearts, not just with our reason, which can easily be caught up in words and small details. In 1925, Edgar Ervast compiled and commented on a version of the Sermon on the Mount. The book discusses Jesus' great speech in an interesting and insightful way. Ervast underscores that we should penetrate the spirit of these teachings. This is the chief aim of this book, to reach the true meaning of Jesus' teachings as closely as possible. I have undertaken this project with the help of wise interpreters, such as Ervast, Paul Brunton, and Deepak Chopra, and by my own reasoning. I have also attempted to uncover the help the Beatitudes could offer for our life in the contemporary world. In addition, each of us should find our own internal interpretation, which resonates within ourselves right now and encourages us to test their usefulness in practice. This prolonged practice takes us to the state in which our minds are opened to understand the scriptures, Luke 24:45, as it says in the Bible. I have no hesitation in stating that this can still happen today. Nowhere in the Beatitudes does Jesus say what one must have to be happy or blessed. Rather, it becomes clear that many of them state, implicitly or explicitly, what one doesn't need, what one should give up or give away to be happy. Jesus focuses on the nature we should have, the attitude towards life we should possess in order to be happy. Each beatitude stresses some feature, ethical attitude, or value. The crucial difference is between having and being. Jesus seems to be telling us that there is no point in pursuing happiness by obtaining external things. Happiness does not adhere to anything in life that is susceptible to change. This truth is reinforced by other passages in the Sermon on the Mount. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moths and vermin do not destroy. These treasures, these prerequisites of happiness, are more like correct attitudes, which manifest themselves in the way we face life situations and treat other people. Indeed, they reveal our spiritual nature. They can serve as helping factors in our lives, and we can affect how they evolve within us. Both Ervast and Brunton have provided their own interpretations of the Beatitudes. They group them differently. Ervast calls the Beatitudes the gate of the kingdom of heaven. In his view, the first and the last proclamation belong together. Both have the same ending. He also connects the second and the seventh and the third and the sixth proclamations, while changing the order of the second and third. Brunton, on the other hand, connects the first and second proclamations. Nevertheless, they end up with very similar ideas. For example, they interpret the Beatitude about the poor in spirit in the same way. The poor in spirit. We have been put here on earth to solve the riddle of matter, that is, the riddle of physical existence. the quintessential symbol of matter in this earthly life, was originally gold. Nowadays, it is usually money. When Jesus speaks of spiritual poverty, he refers to our relationship to possessions and money. As long as we are bound to money, we are neither free nor happy. We need to ponder upon how we could change our relationship with money and property. We must become poor in spirit so that what we own does not bind us in any way. Actually, it doesn't matter whether we are poor or rich. What is important is our internal attitude towards money and mammon. It is true, of course, that Jesus said to the rich man, "Go and sell all your possessions and give the money to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven. Then come, follow me." But the point here is not a mere external renunciation or a generous deed. In a way, Jesus asks, "Are you ready to let go all your possessions to which you have grown so attached and upon which you have based your psychological safety and choose truth and freedom instead, even if it can cause you pain?" This is what Brunton asks. Do you want to choose the way of service? Are you ready to abandon all that is external? Are you ready to choose truth and eternal life, even if you don't know how it will happen? The question reflects our faith in life. Is it possible for a human being to let go of a haven built on money and possessions? Can one free oneself from the addiction of money? Ervast clarifies this question in the following way. Perhaps everyone, upon awakening, renounces his earthly goods, if such there be. The life of the spirit always begins with poverty of heart. And this renunciation assumes the form of an outer symbolic act. The stress, however, is not on outer things. Of this the man poor in heart soon becomes aware. Therefore, he is not frightened if fate places him in charge of possessions. He takes charge of the possessions in the spirit of the apostles. Paul Brunton agrees. We need simplicity, but not asceticism. External gestures of giving up worldly possessions are impractical in the West and are not really necessary. He adds later on, an outward gesture, such as becoming a monk or a nun, or such as giving all your wealth to the poor, is not what Jesus meant. The eco-philosopher Henryk Skolimowski expresses a similar sentiment. Elegant frugality is a precondition of inner beauty. The person who has reached the state of being poor in spirit has taken an important step towards inner liberation. It becomes visible to us as inner beauty. Ervas states that there are three plagues on earth which we have to overcome: poverty, ignorance, and disease. The person who is poor in spirit has assumed a new attitude toward money and possessions. Money does not bind her, nor has she attached herself to it. Money passes through her hands, and she can guide its flow, but her sense of safety is not shaken, even if she has no money at all. She has placed her confidence in the highest power, tested it, and found that it lasts. God is above market fluctuations and devaluations. Deepak Chopra speaks about the same matter in his book, The Seven Spiritual Laws of Success. He frames the sixth law as the law of detachment. It says that in order to have anything in the physical world, we must give up our attachment to it. According to Chopra, we do not have to give up our intentions or desires. All we need to do is to give up attachment to the result. Chopra goes on to justify his interesting claim. Anything you want can be acquired through detachment, because detachment is based on the unquestioning belief in the power of your true self. Attachment, on the other hand, is based on fear and insecurity. We look for security as long as we do not know our true self. Chopra adds, the source of wealth, of abundance, or of anything in the physical world is the self. It is the consciousness who knows how to fulfill every need. Everything else is a symbol: cars, banknotes, clothes, airplanes. Symbols are transitory, they come and go. Chasing symbols is like settling for the map instead of the territory. It creates anxiety. It ends up making you feel hollow and empty inside because you exchange yourself for the symbols of yourself. The Upanishads pose a similar challenge. If people paid as much attention to Brahman, the highest consciousness, as we do to money, who would not be liberated? Jesus Christ is a savior who came to liberate us. He shows us the path from poverty, sickness, and ignorance to bliss and happiness. Paradoxically, when Jesus frees us from poverty, he also frees us from money. More precisely, from clinging on to money, the symbol of matter. How can one become free then? Perhaps the most important sentence in the Sermon on the Mount is the following: "But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well." Finding this kingdom of heaven within will provide the strength needed to change one's heart. The security system created by money and mammon is a fence surrounded by fear. This is where we seek refuge when we don't believe in any other kind of safety. It can be argued that money can buy temporary security, but it doesn't guarantee any lasting security, and true happiness doesn't reside in a safe deposit box. Happiness is always related to freedom. Someone who becomes poor in spirit has started to get in touch with their inner resources. This can be achieved by working, asking, doing, and practicing Jesus' way of life, the yoga of Jesus. Each of us has these resources within. They constitute the spiritual capacity, wisdom, and energy we will find in our inner self, the Christ within all of us. Jesus promises this to all who seek the path. He enigmatically says, "I am the way," John 14:6. That way leads also to the kingdom of heaven. Jesus doesn't say that we will have the kingdom of heaven. He says that we have the kingdom of heaven. Jesus is not referring to the future. The kingdom is already here. Ervast does not comment much on the final beatitude: "Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness." But he does refer to the voluntary poverty practiced by the early Christians and the power it bestowed upon them. Keeping this in mind, one can consider the last beatitude as a supplement to the first. "Let go of your bondage to money and fear not, although society and people will persecute you because of it." Righteousness is a condition for happiness. The world always seeks for happiness using faulty means, and it does not behave well toward those who don't want to be on its foolish treadmill. Brunton, commenting on the same issue, reminds us, "Jesus warned his apostles that they could expect trouble. Always when an apostle or a prophet emerges, it awakens also the resistance by dark and aggressive forces. This is the law of polarity in the world. These forces will find dark and ignorant people who may help to nullify unselfish actions by the enlightened." The mystery of grief. In his second beatitude, Jesus says, "Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted." Brunton connects this beatitude to the first, and he sees them as a unity. He views mourning and renouncing mammon as related. This renunciation could occur either with the will, which is, as is well known, hard to do, or without it. A person is stripped down and notices that he has lost all his possessions, close relatives, home, furniture, everything. Only few have the matured wisdom, understanding, and courage to bear the harsh truth that the world is just a campsite, says Brunton. Understanding that renunciation is inevitable causes mourning, but this mourning is valuable. Ervast, on the other hand, connects the second beatitude with the sixth: "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God." Nevertheless, the spirit of his interpretation is the same as Brunton's. According to Ervast, purity of heart is not merely a matter of sexual purity. It has to do with the larger scope of the emotional life, such as freedom from envy, revenge, and bitterness. In other words, the second beatitude refers directly to all five of Jesus' commandments, which are practiced in the path of purification: calmness of mind, purity of heart, speaking the truth, non-resistance to evil, and the greatest commandment, love. Similarly, it points toward the Lord's Prayer: and forgive us our debts, as we have forgiven our debtors. It is evident that our heart has not been purified as long as we are unable to forgive those who have trespassed against us. According to Ervast, purification of the heart is followed by no whimpering lamentation, only a silent sadness caused by the loneliness that befalls a heart that becomes purified and dead to the world. The grief spoken of in the Beatitude is that feeling of emptiness which is the result of the death of the egotistic personality. It is a melancholy sadness, which in itself is its own mysterious consolation, whose apotheosis is the seeing of God. The pure heart is born out of renunciation, dying to the world. Those who are pure of heart have renounced their earthly attitudes, which are like armor: anger, aggressiveness, insulting, lying, and concealment. All these armaments are a refuge from the battering and violence of the world, and they are built upon a central emotion: fear. Fear lives in a heart that is not pure. When everyone is afraid, all must take cover in the armor of offense, revenge, anger, and violence. No one dares to show how they really feel. By and large, we are living today in this stalemate. Jesus came to unravel this situation almost 2,000 years ago, but his lesson has not struck home very rapidly. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted, is often interpreted without much thought, as meaning that worrying about injustice, suffering, and catastrophes in the world somehow makes a person happier. Worrying is a part of everyday life for most people who try to comprehend the world. They usually grieve about the state of the world, which they combine with a combative attitude toward many kinds of evil, abuse, and disaster. This kind of worrier has not yet woken up to the true meaning and nature of suffering. Indeed, understanding the nature of suffering is part of comprehending the meaning of evil and acknowledging its necessary role in the evolution of the visible world. Worrying also signals distress about the state of the world. One asks why this is the case and why God allows it to happen. This is a justified question, but satisfactory and consoling answers require pondering. This calls for both patience and faith in life. When we examine this issue from the point of view of humanity's wise sages, we get the unanimous answer that everything in the world is in order. This surprising and difficult answer originates from the idea that suffering and evil are an inseparable part of the dualistic polar nature of the world. Suffering is our teacher. It is closely connected with reincarnation and karma. According to the law of cause and effect, we always create suffering when we, individually or collectively, break the law of life. Suffering begins to weaken when we find the right relationship to reality and evil, and when we stop fearing suffering and death, which is nothing but a transition to another level of consciousness. It may be that suffering does not end when we leave the world, but changes its form in our consciousness. We come back to the world time after time to learn not to resist evil and to love all created beings. It is our human calling to grow with this understanding. Pain may well be intensified by increasing knowledge, but when knowledge changes into wisdom, the path eases up. What about God's responsibility? God does not interfere with our actions. We have been given both free will and responsibility. the opportunity to choose in the school of good and evil. Life invites all of us to become wiser. Each of us has an opportunity to perceive good and evil as our teachers. When we try, we will be helped to see. The great life helps everyone who strives to go forward toward wisdom, compassion, love, and freedom. In the fourth beatitude, Jesus promises that the righteous, that is, those who have set their minds on the right path, will have happy days. The righteous are not worried anymore, although they perform loving service in the world. The righteous are the people who have begun to see the world not only as a school of painful endeavor, but also as the best of all possible worlds, which, through our efforts, can become a happy place. The righteous begin to see that good and evil are related to each other and entail each other, and also see the unity behind the antitheses of visible life. We have come from the unity, and we will return to it, enriched by all of our experiences after this great wave of evolution is over. The laws of karma and reincarnation ensure that justice is always strictly maintained in this dualistic world of polarities. The righteous, who understand that the whole universe is balanced in this way, see that suffering also has its role in evolution, and there is no need to worry. Naturally, suffering can and must be alleviated, and those who suffer must be helped, but this is another matter. I am aware that as a philosophy of wisdom, this kind of thinking is not very appealing in our time because there is no quick payoff available and everyone is in a rush. But life is not a supermarket in which one can buy instant consolation, love, wisdom, or salvation. Of course, one can try to obtain all this. There are instant merchants in the spiritual domain as well, but instant in the context of truly important things means that the commodities soon become scarce. We are not in a hurry. We have all the time we want to learn those things. With each new incarnation, we are given new opportunities to learn the lesson of life. Few people learn it within one life. Many people reject the idea of reincarnation, saying that they do not wish to come here again. Yet how many of us are prepared to take steps so that we won't have to come back? In regard to the saying that those who mourn will find comfort, could Jesus mean that one can worry after all, that one is not supposed to worry about worrying? Perhaps worrying is a good thing. This could be a paradox in Jesus' teachings. Worry can drive a logical person to action, to take responsibility, which makes it possible for reality to unfold. But we can go through various reform movements only to realize that we must start from ourselves. We must first put things right in our own lives. Incomplete people cannot build a complete world. Perhaps there is a long way to go to the state of mind in which one can truly live in the knowledge that everything is in order. The person who attains that consciousness is righteous and most likely much happier than her brother who continues to worry. These thoughts arose in my mind when I pondered the happiness in mourning. It is a sign that there can be many interpretations. They also may vary depending on where one stands in one's spiritual path and what one needs at that point. Everyone is free to look for an interpretation that best suits their advancement. However, if one practices honest thinking, there can be no great harm. Happiness of the Peacemaker. Urvast connects the following Beatitudes as the third pair. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth, and blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called the sons of God. Indeed, the meek and the peacemakers seem to belong together. They have learned Jesus' first commandment in practice: do not get angry with your brother. Furthermore, the interpretation of these Beatitudes is intimately connected to Jesus' fourth commandment: do not resist evil. The meek and the peacemakers are called happy, meaning that they have mastered the art of forgiving. In the Lord's Prayer, Jesus teaches us to pray for the strength to forgive when he says, "And forgive us our debts, as we also have forgiven our debtors." In this way, the person builds inner harmony, gentleness, and peace. From this perspective, the third pair of Beatitudes appears as ethically clear and binding. When we look at how the world has treated the meek and the peacemakers, we can't help wondering if they could possibly be happy. On the other hand, they have learned how to live without anger and fear. This alone fulfills one condition for happiness. Moreover, it is possible to imagine what the world would be like if all of us concentrated on learning how to avoid getting angry. Moreover, it is possible to imagine what the world would be like if all of us concentrated on learning how to avoid getting angry. This would teach us how to build inner peace. World history tells us about amazing people who have practiced kindness and created peace around themselves. The old legends are filled with these heroes, the righteous who know how to repay evil with good. They are the ones who've thrown themselves in front of spears and guns, as happened in India's struggle for independence, led by Mahatma Gandhi. They are heroes, martyrs, the blessed, who shall eventually inherit the earth and who will be called the sons of God. Gandhi was helped by the conviction that we will reincarnate again on earth, and that death is just a gate to a new state of reality. After purification and rest, we have a chance to continue our righteous endeavors. Happiness is not just a reward waiting for us in the future. I recall a TV interview about a Polish family man who had decided to burn himself alive in a great festival in the Warsaw Stadium in order to oppose the communist regime. After he made his decision, he traveled to the stadium by train. He said that his mind was filled with great peace and happiness. Another example could be my friend Berti, who as a young man decided to refuse to serve in the army. He told me that while he was traveling to military headquarters, he felt very brave, as if he had been inflated the size of a house. Only the person who has undertaken an exceptional act can tell what it feels like. Happiness is a subjective state of mind. Although it can be externally perceived and to some extent transmitted to other people, it cannot be fully fathomed. It must be brought about by one's own thinking and actions. Happiness is a subjective state of mind. Although it can be externally perceived and to some extent transmitted to other people, it cannot be fully fathomed. It must be brought about by one's own thinking and actions. The peacemakers and the meek have learned how to deal with the conditions of life without forcing them in any way. There is no need to do anything, and nothing is worth doing by force. Deepak Chopra talks about this attitude in his book as the law of least effort, with examples taken from the Indian tradition. He says, "This is the principle of least action, of no resistance. If you observe nature at work, you will see that least effort is expended. Grass doesn't try to grow, it just grows. The principle is, do less and accomplish more. Ultimately, the aim is to achieve the state in which nothing is done, yet everything is accomplished." Chopra quotes Carlos Castaneda. "Most of our energy goes into upholding our importance. If we were capable of losing some of that importance, two extraordinary things would happen to us. One, we would free our energy from trying to maintain the illusory idea of our grandeur. And two, we would provide ourselves with enough energy to catch a glimpse of the actual grandeur of the universe." Chopra divides the law of least effort into three components, which seem to be useful in evaluating these particular beatitudes. Chopra speaks first of acceptance, which is a path to understanding that everything is in order. He notes that acceptance simply means deciding that, quote, "Today I will accept people, situations, circumstances, and events as they occur. This means I will know that this moment is as it should be, because the whole universe is as it should be. This moment, the one you're experiencing right now, is the culmination of all the moments you have experienced in the past. This moment is as it is because the entire universe is as it is. When you struggle against this moment, you're actually struggling against the entire universe. Instead, you can make the decision that today you will not struggle against the whole universe by struggling against this moment. This means that your acceptance of this moment is total and complete. You accept things as they are, not as you wish they were in this moment. This is important to understand. You can wish for things in the future to be different, but in this moment, you have to accept things as they are. When you feel frustrated or upset by a person or a situation, remember that you are not reacting to the person or the situation, but to your feelings about the person or the situation. These are your feelings, and your feelings are not someone else's fault. When you recognize and understand this completely, you are ready to take responsibility for how you feel and to change it. And if you can accept things as they are, you are ready to take responsibility for your situation and for all the events you see as problems. End of quote. This leads to the second component of the law of least effort, responsibility. Chopra asks, what does responsibility mean? And answers, quote, responsibility means not blaming anyone or anything for your situation, including yourself. Having accepted this circumstance, this event, this problem, responsibility then means the ability to have a creative response to the situation as it is now. All problems contain the seeds of opportunity, and this awareness allows you to take the moment and transform it to a better situation or thing. Once you do this, every so-called upsetting situation will become an opportunity for the creation of something new and beautiful, and every so-called tormentor or tyrant will become your teacher. Reality is an interpretation. And if you choose to interpret reality in this way, you will have many teachers around you and many opportunities to evolve. End of quote. Chopra then continues to the third component of the law of least effort, which is defenselessness. Quote, it means that your awareness is established in defenselessness, and you have relinquished the need to convince or persuade others of your point of view. If you observe people around you, you'll see that they spend 99% of their time defending their points of view. If you just relinquish the need to defend your point of view, you will, in that relinquishment, gain access to enormous amounts of energy that have previously been wasted. If you embrace the present and become one with it and merge with it, you will experience a fire, a glow, a sparkle of ecstasy throbbing in every living sentient being. As you begin to experience this exaltation of spirit in everything that is alive, as you become intimate, joy will be born within you, and you will drop the terrible burdens and encumbrances of defensiveness, resentment, and hurtfulness. Only then will you become lighthearted, carefree, joyous, and free. End of quote. Righteousness and mercy. Urvast's interpretation of the Beatitudes places them in pairs, in a new order, and calls the arc formed by them the gate of the kingdom of heaven. The last two pearls of this gate are the proclamations that are centermost, that is, the fourth and fifth Beatitudes. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they will be filled, and blessed are the merciful, for they shall be shown mercy. I have already discussed this righteousness, or, as Urvast translated it, the thought of righteousness and mercy. The righteous can elevate their minds to the point where they conclude that everything is in order in the world. This cannot simply mean leaving everything and doing nothing. Urvast places mercy alongside righteousness. Mercy, today we might speak of compassion or pity, helping a suffering neighbor. has the consequences, says Jesus, that one will be shown mercy in turn. A similar idea is expressed in the Lord's Prayer, and forgive us our debts, as we also have forgiven our debtors. As the saying goes, the world you get is the world you give away. Mercy is about forgiving, loving service, and deeds of love in everyday life. This beatitude, together with Jesus' fifth commandment, the commandment of love, provides us with a key to happiness on earth. There is an enormous amount of suffering on earth, and we have no certainty of avoiding it, even if we have created vast systems to prevent ourselves from seeing it. It is a tall order to put an end to suffering, but we can change our attitude towards it. This does not mean indifference. It is loving work done with compassion and mercy. Such an attitude teaches us to see how suffering could be brought to an end in the world. The reasons for our suffering are our own deeds, our own cynicism, indifference, selfishness, and cruelty. God does not want us to suffer in pain. God and His Son teach us how to deal with it so that it might no longer be with us, and we could have a kingdom of heaven here on earth. If we can be merciful, mercy will come back to us when we are suffering. I believe that mercy and compassion can offset old karma. Loving service always brings a blessing, both to the person who receives the service and to the person giving it. Ehrvost refers to the close connection between mercy, compassion, and love when he asks, "What justice would there be on earth without love? How could we realize justice without being full of understanding, pity, sympathy, and forgiveness for one another?" Moreover, can we put mercy before justice in our own lives? This is the righteousness that truth seekers must bring to the world. We can start small and enlarge the circle of mercy and compassion with our strength. It is a great and wonderful challenge in life to move from suffering to happiness. Both the Beatitude concerning mercy and the first Beatitude concerning the poor in spirit suggest that happiness is created by creating happiness for other people. Our own comfort or pleasure is no longer our first concern. We start by bringing small crumbs of happiness into the midst of suffering. Condolence, understanding, and helping are themselves a medicine. They bring consolation. They also contribute to our own happiness, which extends even to our post-mortem life. The wise say that your personal heaven is created by the thoughts of people who love you. Mercy and forgiveness are accompanied by a new kind of humility, which helps one to be free from the need for revenge. When pondering on mercy, it is advisable to think about the situation in which Jesus lived. At that time, life was much harsher and crueler. Revenge has long roots in history, and it extends to our time. It has upheld cohesion among tribes and nationalities, but at the same time, it has had a demoralizing effect. The secret of happiness. In addition to the Beatitudes, there is one more condition for happiness, which is linked to the question of the meaning of life. Happiness is clearly related to the questions, why do I live and what is the meaning of my life? I must somehow see that there is some sense in my own life as well as in life as a whole. Happiness, in this sense, is bound to the meaningfulness of my work. Of course, this is not just about paid work. It entails my dharma, that is, my mission in life, my purpose on earth. Happiness can ultimately lie in finding meaning and seeing how everything fits together, even momentarily. Happiness, or bliss, in the sense that Jesus meant, is a dynamic state of harmony in which the meaningfulness of life is present in every changing moment. It is the present moment, as Deepak Chopra says. Another meaning for the word present is gift. It often seems that finding meaning in life in itself constitutes a foundation for carrying on. But Jesus' Beatitudes take us even further. They promise us bliss. Finally, let me return to the title of this chapter, the happiness that I have given away? Is it only when I learn to give away something important to me, when I learn to renounce, to give away even my own happiness, that I start creating conditions for my own happiness? Is this what great life teaches us? Yes. It teaches us love as it teaches us to give. The crucial point is to give up our convenience. One could almost say to give up happiness. It is about giving up the following. Superficial satisfactions from goods, wealth, and the related false sense of power and pride. Complacency and a self-centered attitude. Being overly talkative. Pursuing easy solutions and easy pleasures. The constant need to be right. Self-indulgence. The lust for revenge and retribution. Happiness is a secret mystery which can be oriented not toward rewards or personal happiness, but toward seeking for the right things, clearer understanding, surrender, serving others, divine wisdom. I will finish this chapter with a poem written by my son Eero for his mother when he was about 6 years old. When the leaves of the fall come down and things are not so good, you will look for something new. You must look for something new. Life is the secret of happiness.